Bridget's mournful yowl was even louder out here, and Tessa heard Gideon say something to Sophie about it, and Sophie's soft voice in response, before they were too far away for her to hear them anymore. It seemed natural to fall into step beside Jem as they went downstairs and through the nave of the cathedral. She was walking close enough to him that, though they did not speak, she could feel the warmth of him against her side, the brush of his bare hand against hers as they stepped outside. Sunset was coming. The sky had begun to take on the bronze sheen that came just before twilight. Cyril was waiting on the front steps, looking so much like Thomas that it hurt one's heart to look at him. He was carrying a long, thin dagger, which he handed off to Will without a word. Will took it and put it through his belt. Charlotte turned and put her hand against Tessa's cheek.
"We shall see you at the warehouse," she said. "You will be perfectly safe, Tessa. And thank you for doing this for us."
Charlotte dropped her hand and went down the steps, Henry following her, and Will just after. Jem hesitated, just for a moment, and Tessa, remembering a night like this one when he had run up the steps to bid her goodbye, pressed her fingers lightly against his wrist.
"Mispa," she said.
She heard him suck in his breath. The shadow hunters were getting into the carriage. He turned and kissed her quickly on the cheek, before spinning and running down the steps after the others. None of them seemed to have noticed, but Tessa put her hand to her face as Jem climbed, last, into the carriage, and Henry made his way up to the driver's seat. The gates of the Institute swung open, and the carriage clattered out into the darkening afternoon.
"Shall we go then, miss?"
Cyril inquired. Despite how much he looked like Thomas, Tessa thought, he had a less diffident demeanor. He looked her directly in the eye when he spoke, and the corners of his mouth always seemed to be about to crinkle into a smile. She wondered if there was always one calmer and one more high-strung brother, like Gabriel and Gideon.
"Yes, I think we—"
Tessa stopped suddenly, one foot about to descend the steps. It was ridiculous, she knew, and yet she had taken off the clockwork angel to dress herself in Jessamine's clothes. She had not put it back on. Well, she couldn't wear it. Nate would recognize it immediately. But she had meant to put it into her pocket for luck, and she had forgotten. She hesitated now. It was more than silly superstition. Twice now the angel had literally saved her life. She turned. "I have forgotten something. Wait here for me, Cyril. I'll only be a moment." The door to the Institute was still open. She charged back through it and up the stairs, through the halls and into the corridor that led to Jessamine's room, where she froze. Jessamine's hall was the same hall that led to the steps to the training room. She had seen Sophie and Gideon disappear down it minutes ago. Only they had not disappeared. They were still there. The light was low, and they were only shadows in the dimness, but Tessa could see them plainly. Sophie, standing against the wall, and Gideon, pressing her hand. Tessa took a step backward, her heart jerking inside her chest. Neither of them saw her. They seemed entirely concentrated on each other. Gideon leaned in then, murmuring something to Sophie. Gently he brushed a stray strand of hair from her face. Tessa's stomach tensed, and she turned and crept away, as soundlessly as she could. The sky had turned a shade darker when she came back out onto the steps. Cyril was there, whistling off-key. He broke off abruptly when he saw Tessa's expression.
"Is everything all right, miss? Did you get what you wanted?"
Tessa thought of Gideon moving Sophie's hair away from her face. She remembered Will's hands gentle on her waist, and the softness of Jem's kiss on her cheek, and felt as if her mind were whirling. Who was she to tell Sophie to be careful, even silently, when she was so lost herself?
"Yes," she lied. "I got what I wanted, thank you, Cyril."
The warehouse was a great limestone building surrounded by a black wrought iron fence. The windows had been boarded over, and a stout iron padlock held closed the front gates, over which the blackening name of Mortmain and Co. could barely be seen below layers of soot. The shadow hunters left the carriage drawn up to the curb, with a glamour on it to prevent it from being stolen or molested by passing mundanes, at least until Cyril arrived to wait with it. A closer inspection of the padlock showed Will that it had been oiled recently and opened. A rune took care of the lack of a key, and he and the others slipped inside, closing the gate behind them. Another rune unlocked the front door, leading them into a suite of offices. Only one was still furnished, with a desk, a green shaded lamp, and a floral sofa with a high carved back. "Doubtless where Jessamine and Nate accomplished the majority of their courtship," Will observed cheerfully. Jem made a noise of disgust and poked at the couch with his cane. Charlotte was bending over the desk, hastily going through the drawers.
"I didn't realize you'd taken up such a strong anti-courtship stance," Will observed to Jem.
"Not on principle. The thought of Nate Gray touching anyone," Jem made a face. "And Jessamine is so convinced he loves her. If you could see her, I think you might pity her, Will."
"I would not," said Will. "Unrequited love is a ridiculous state, and it makes those in it behave ridiculously." He tugged at the bandage on his arm as if it were paining him. "Charlotte, the desk?"
"Nothing." She slid the drawers shut. "Some papers listing the prices of tea and the times of tea auctions, but other than that, nothing but dead spiders."
"How romantic," murmured Will.
He ducked behind Jem, who had already wandered ahead into the adjacent office, using his cane to sweep away cobwebs as he went. The next few rooms were empty, and the last opened out onto what had once been a warehouse floor. It was a great, shadowy, cavernous space, its ceiling disappearing up into the darkness. Rickety wooden steps led up to a second-floor gallery. Burlap bags were propped against the walls on the first floor, looking for all the world in the shadows like slumped bodies. Will raised his witch-like runestone in one hand, sending out spokes of light through the room as Henry went to investigate one of the sacks. He was back in a moment, shrugging his shoulders.
"Broken bits of loose-leaf tea," he said. "Orange pekoe, from the looks of it."
But Jem was shaking his head, glancing about.
"I am perfectly willing to accept this was an active tea-trading office at one point, but it's clearly been shuttered for years, ever since Mortmain decided to interest himself in mechanisms instead. And yet the floor is clear of dust."
He took Will's wrist, guiding the beam of witchlight over the smooth wooden floor.
"There has been activity here, more than simply Jessamine and Nate's meeting in a disused office." "There are more offices that way," said Henry, pointing to the far end of the room. "Charlotte and I will search them. Will, Jem, you examine the second floor."
It was a rare and novel thrill when Henry gave orders. Will looked up at Jem and grinned, and commenced making his way up the rickety wooden stairs. The steps creaked under the pressure, and under Jem's slighter weight behind Will. The witchlight stone in Will's hand threw sharp patterns of light against the wall as he reached the top step. He found himself on a gallery, a platform where perhaps trunks of tea had been stored, or a foreman had watched the floor below. It was empty now, save for a single figure lying on the ground. The body of a man, slim and youthful, and as Will came closer, his heart began to pound crazily. Because he had seen this before, had had this vision before. The limp body, the silver hair and dark clothes, the closed, bruised-looking eyes, fringed with silver lashes. "Will?" It was Jem, behind him. He looked from Will's silent, stunned face to the body on the floor and pushed past him to kneel down. He took the man by the wrist just as Charlotte reached the top of the steps. Will looked at her in surprise for a moment. Her face was sheened with sweat, and she looked slightly ill. Jem said, "He has a pulse. Will." Will came closer and knelt down beside his friend. At this distance, it was easy to see that the man on the floor was not Jem. He was older and Caucasian. He had a growth of silver stubble on his chin and cheeks, and his features were broader and less defined. Will's heartbeat slowed as the man's eyes fluttered open. They were silver discs, like Jem's, and in that moment Will recognized him. He smelt the sweet-sour tang of burning warlock drugs, felt the heat of them in his veins, and knew that he had seen this man before, and knew where.
"You're a werewolf," he said. "One of the Pactless ones, buying Yin Fen off the Ifrits down the chapel, aren't you?"
The werewolf's eyes roamed over them both, and fastened on Jem. His lids narrowed, and his hands shot out, grabbing Jem by the lapels.
"You," he wheezed, "you are one of us. Have you got any of it on you? Any of the stuff?"
Jem recoiled. Will seized the werewolf by the wrist and yanked his hand free. It wasn't difficult. There was very little strength in his nerveless fingers.
"Don't touch him."
Will heard his own voice as if from a distance. "He doesn't have any of your filthy powder. It doesn't work on us Nephilim like it does on you."
"Will,"
there was a plea in Jem's voice.
"Be kinder."
"You work for Mortmain," said Will. "Tell us what you do for him. Tell us where he is."
The werewolf laughed. Blood splashed over his lips and dribbled down his chin. Some of it splattered onto Jem's gear.
"As if I'd know where the Magister is," he wheezed. "Bloody fools. The pair of you. Bloody useless Nephilim. If I had me strength, I'd chop you into bloody rags."
"But you don't," Will was remorseless. "And maybe we do have some Yin Fen."
"You don't? You think I don't know?"
The werewolf's eyes wandered.
"When he gave it to me first, I saw things, such things you can't imagine. The great crystal city, the towers of heaven."
Another spasming cough racked him. More blood splattered. It had a silvery sheen to it, like mercury. Will exchanged a look with Jem.
The crystal city.
He couldn't help thinking of Alicante, though he had never been there.
"I thought I were going to live forever. Work all night, all day, never get tired. And then we started dying off, one by one. The drug, it kills you, but he never said. I came back here to see if maybe there was still any of it stashed somewhere. But there's none. No point leaving. I'm dying now. Might as well die here as anywhere."
"He knew what he was doing when he gave you that drug," said Jem. "He knew it would kill you. He doesn't deserve your secrecy. Tell us what he was doing.
What he was keeping you working on all day and night." "Putting those things together. Those metal men. They don't half give you the willies, but the money were good, and the drugs were better."
"And a great deal of good that money will do you now," said Jem, his voice uncharacteristically bitter. "How often did he make you take it? That silver powder?"
6, 7 times a day."
"No wonder they're running out of it down the chapel," Will muttered. "Mortmain's controlling the supply." "You're not supposed to take it like that," said Jem. "The more you take, the faster you will die." The werewolf fixed his gaze on Jem. His eyes were shot through with red veins.
"And you?"
he said.
"How much longer have you got left?"
Will turned his head. Charlotte was motionless behind him at the top of the stairs, staring. He raised a hand to gesture her over. "Charlotte, if we can get him downstairs, perhaps the Silent Brothers can do something to help him. If you could..." But Charlotte, to Will's surprise, had turned a pale shade of green. She clapped her hand over her mouth and dashed downstairs.
"Charlotte!"
Will hissed. He didn't dare shout.
"Oh, bloody hell."
"All right, Jem. You take his legs, I'll take his shoulders." "There's no point, Will." Jem's voice was soft. "He's dead." Will turned back. "Indeed." The silver eyes were wide open, glassy, fixed on the ceiling. The chest had ceased to rise and fall. Jem reached to close his eyelids, but Will caught his friend by the wrist.
"Don't."
"I wasn't going to give him the blessing, Will. Just close his eyes."
"He doesn't deserve that.
He was working with the Magister." Will's whisper was rising to a shout.
"He is like me,"
said Jem simply.
"An addict."
Will looked at him over their joined hands.
"He's not like you." and you will not die like that.
Jem's lips parted in surprise.
Will?
They both heard the sound of a door opening, and a voice calling out Jessamine's name. Will released Jem's wrist, and both of them dropped flat to the ground, inching to the edge of the gallery to see what was happening on the warehouse floor. Chapter 16. Mortal Rage. When I have seen, by time's fell hand defaced, the rich proud cost of outworn buried age, when sometime lofty towers I see downraised, and brass eternal slave to mortal rage. Shakespeare, Sonnet 64. It was a peculiar experience walking the streets of London as a boy, Tessa thought as she made her way along the crowded pavement of Eastcheap. The men who crossed her path spared her barely a glance, just pushed past her toward the doors of public houses or the next turn in the street. As a girl, walking alone through these streets, at night in her fine clothes, she would have been the object of stares and jeers. As a boy, she was invisible. She had never realized what it was like to be invisible before. How light and free she felt, or would have felt, had she not felt like an aristocrat from A Tale of Two Cities on his way to the guillotine in a tumbril. She caught sight of Cyril only once, slipping between two buildings across the road from 32 Mincing Lane. It was a great stone building, and the black iron fence surrounding it in the vanishing twilight looked like rows of jagged black teeth. From the front gate dangled a padlock, but it had been left open. She slipped through, and then up the dusty steps to the front door, which was also unlocked. Inside, she found that the empty offices, their windows looking out onto Mincing Lane, were still and dead. A fly buzzed in one, hurling itself over and over against the plated glass panes until it fell, exhausted, to the sill. Tessa shuddered and hurried on. In each room she walked into, she tensed, expecting to see Nate. In each room, he was not there. The final room had a door that opened out onto the floor of a warehouse. Dim blue light filtered in through the cracks in the boarded-up windows. She looked around uncertainly.
"Nate?"
she whispered. He stepped out of the shadows, between two flaking plaster pillars. His blonde hair shone in the bluish light, under a silk-top hat. He wore a blue tweed frock coat, black trousers, and black boots, but his usually immaculate appearance was disheveled. His hair hung lankily in his eyes, and there was a smear of dirt across his cheek. His clothes were wrinkled and creased as if he had slept in them.
"Jessamine," he said, relief evident in his tone. He opened his arms. She came forward slowly, her whole body tensed. She did not want Nate touching her, but she could see no way to avoid his embrace. His arms went around her. His hand caught the brim of her hat and pulled it free, letting her fair curls tumble down her back. She thought of Will pulling the pins from her hair, and her stomach involuntarily tightened.
"I need to know where the Magister is," she began in a shaking voice. "It's terribly important. I overheard some of the Shadowhunters' plans, you see. I know you didn't wish to tell me, but..."
He pushed her hair back, ignoring her words.
"I see," he said, and his voice was deep and husky. "But first..."
He tipped her head up with a finger under her chin.
"Come and kiss me, sweet and twenty."
Tessa wished he wouldn't quote Shakespeare. She'd never be able to hear that sonnet again without wanting to be sick. Every nerve in her body wanted to leap, screaming through her skin in revulsion as he leaned toward her. She prayed for the others to burst in as she let him tilt her head up, up. Nate began to laugh. With a jerk of his wrist, he sent her hat sailing into the shadows. His fingers tightened on her chin, the nails digging in.
"My apologies for my impetuous behavior," he said. "I couldn't help but be curious to see how far you'd go to protect your Shadowhunter friends, little sister."
"Nate," Tessa tried to jerk backward, out of his grasp, but his grip on her was too strong. His other hand shot out like a snake, spinning her around, pinning her against him with his forearm across her throat. His breath was hot against her ear. He smelled sour, like old gin and sweat.
"Did you really think I didn't know?" he spat.
"After that note arrived at Benedict's ball, sending me off on that wild goose chase to Vauxhall, I realized that it all made sense. I should have known it was you from the beginning, stupid little girl."
"Stupid?" she hissed. "I got you to spill your secrets, Nate. You told me everything. Did Mormaine find out? Is that why you look like you haven't slept in days?"
He jerked his arm tighter around her, making her gasp with pain. "You couldn't leave well enough alone. You had to pry into my business. Delighted to see me brought low, aren't you? What kind of sister does that make you, Tessie?"
"You would have killed me if you had the chance. There is no game you can play, nothing you can say to make me think I've betrayed you, Nate. You earn every bit of it, allying yourself with Mortmain."
He shook her, hard enough to make her teeth rattle. "As if my alliances are any of your business. I was doing well for myself until you and your Nephilim friends came and meddled. Now, the Magister wants my head on the block. Your fault. All your fault. I was almost in despair till I got that ridiculous note from Jessamine. I knew you were behind it, of course. All the trouble you must have gone through, too. Torturing her to get her to write me that ridiculous missive."
"We didn't torture her," Tessa ground out.
She struggled, but Nate only held her more tightly, the buttons on his waistcoat digging into her back.
"She wanted to do it. She wanted to save her own skin."
"I don't believe you." The hand that wasn't across her throat gripped her chin. His nails dug in, and she yelped with pain.
"She loves me." "No one could love you," Tessa spat. "You're my brother. I loved you. And you have killed even that."
Nate leaned forward and growled.
"I am not your brother." "Very well, my half-brother, if you must have it."
"You're not my sister, not even by half." He said the words with a cruel pleasure. "Your mother and my mother were not the same woman."
"That's not possible," Tessa whispered. "You're lying.
Our mother was Elizabeth Gray." "Your mother was Elizabeth Gray, born Elizabeth Moore," said Knight. "Mine was Harriet Moore."
"Aunt Harriet?"
"She was engaged once. Did you know that? After our parents, your parents, were married. The man died before the wedding could take place, but she was already with child. Your mother raised the baby as hers to spare her sister the shame of the world knowing she had consummated her marriage before it had taken place. That she was a whore." His voice was as bitter as poison. "I'm not your brother, and I never was. Harriet, she never told me she was my mother. I found out from your mother's letters. All those years, and she never said a word. She was too ashamed."
"You killed her," Tessa said numbly. "Your own mother."
"Because she was my mother. Because she disowned me. Because she was ashamed of me. Because I'll never know who my father was. Because she was a whore." Nate's voice was empty. Nate had always been empty. It had never been anything but a pretty shell. And Tessa and her aunt had dreamed into him empathy and compassion and sympathetic weakness because they had wanted to see it there. Not because it was.
"Why did you tell Jessamine that my mother was a shadow hunter?" Tessa demanded. "Even if Aunt Harriet was your mother, she and my mother were sisters. Aunt Harriet would have been a shadow hunter too, and so would you. Why tell such a ridiculous lie?"
He smirked. "Wouldn't you like to know?" His grip tightened on her neck, choking her. She gasped and thought suddenly of Gabriel saying, "Aim at the kneecaps. The pain is agonizing." She kicked up and backward, the heel of her boot colliding with Nate's knee, making a dull cracking sound. Nate yelled, and his leg went out from under him. He kept his grip on Tessa as he fell, rolling so that his elbow jammed into her stomach as they tumbled to the ground together. She gasped, the air punched from her lungs, her eyes filling with tears. She kicked out at him again, trying to scramble backward, and caught him a glancing blow on the shoulder, but he lunged at her, seizing her by the waistcoat. The buttons popped off it in a rain as he dragged her toward him. His other hand gripped her hair as she flailed out at him, raking her nails down his cheek. The blood that sprang immediately to the surface was a savagely satisfying sight.
"Let me go," she panted. "You can't kill me. The Magister wants me alive."
"Alive is not unhurt," Nate snarled, blood running down his face and off his chin. He knotted his hand in her hair and dragged her toward him. She screamed at the pain and lashed out with her boots, but he was nimble, dodging her flailing feet. Panting, she sent up a silent call.
"Jem, Will, Charlotte, Henry, where are you?"
"Wondering where your friends are?" He hauled her back to her feet, one hand in her hair, the other fisted in the back of her shirt. "Well, here's one of them at least." A grinding noise alerted Tessa to a movement in the shadows. Nate dragged her head around by the hair, shaking it.
"Look," he spat. "It's time you knew what you were up against."
Tessa stared. The thing that emerged from the shadows was gigantic. 20 feet tall, she guessed, made of iron. There was barely any jointure. It appeared to move as one single fluid mechanism, seamless and almost featureless. Its bottom half did split into legs, each one ending in a foot tipped with metal spikes. Its arms were the same, finishing in claw-like hands, and its head was a smooth oval, broken only by a wide, jagged-toothed mouth, like a crack in an egg. A pair of twisting silvery horns spiraled up from its head. A thin line of blue fire crackled between them. In its enormous hands, it carried a limp body, dressed in gear. Against the bulk of the gigantic automaton, she looked even smaller than ever.
"Charlotte!"
Tessa screamed. She redoubled her attempts to get away from Nate, whipping her head to the side. Some of her hair tore free and fluttered to the ground. Jessamine's fair hair, stained now with blood. Nate retaliated by slapping her hard enough that she saw stars. When she sagged, he caught her around the throat, the buttons on his cuffs digging into her windpipe. Nate chuckled. "A prototype," he said. "Abandoned by the Magister, too large and cumbersome for his purposes, but not for mine." He raised his voice. "Drop her." The automaton's metal hands opened. Charlotte tumbled free and struck the ground with a sickening thump. She lay unmoving. From this distance, Tessa could not tell if her chest was rising and falling or not.
"Now crush her," said Nate.
Ponderously, the thing raised its spiked metal foot. Tessa clawed at Nate's forearms, ripping his skin with her nails.
"Charlotte!"
For a moment, Tessa thought the voice screaming was her own. But it was too low-pitched for that. A figure darted out from behind the automaton, a figure all in black, topped by a shock of blazing ginger hair, a thin-bladed misericord in hand. Henry. Without even a glance at Tessa and Nate, he launched himself at the automaton, bringing his blade down in a long, curving arc. There was a clang of metal on metal, sparks flew, and the automaton staggered back. Its foot came down, slamming into the floor, inches from Charlotte's supine body. Henry landed, then threw himself at the creature again, slashing out with his blade. The blade shattered. For a moment, Henry simply stood and looked at it with stupid shock. Then the creature's hand whipped forward and seized him by the arm. He shouted out as it lifted him and threw him with incredible force against one of the pillars. He struck it, crumpled, and fell to the floor, where he lay still. Nate laughed.
"Such a display of matrimonial devotion," he said. "Who would have thought? Jessamine always said she thought Branwell couldn't stand his wife."
"You're a pig," Tessa said, struggling in his grasp. "What do you know about the things people do for each other? If Jessamine were burning to death, you wouldn't look up from your card game. You care for nothing but yourself."
"Be quiet, or I'll loosen your teeth for you." Nate shook her again,
and called out,
"Come, over here. You must hold her until the Magister arrives."
With a grinding of gears, the automaton moved to obey. It was not as swift as its smaller brethren, but its size was such that Tessa could not help but follow its movements with an icy fear. And that was not all. The Magister was coming. Tessa wondered if Nate had summoned him yet, if he was on his way. Mortmain. Even the memory of his cold eyes, his icy, controlling smile made her stomach turn. "Let me go," she cried, jerking away from her brother. "Let me go to Charlotte." Nate shoved her forward, hard, and she sprawled on the ground, her elbows and knees connecting with force with the hard wooden floor. She gasped and rolled sideways under the shadow of the second floor gallery as the automaton lumbered toward her. She cried out, and they leaped from the gallery above. Will and Jem, each landing on a shoulder of the creature. It roared, a sound like bellows being fed with coal, and staggered back, allowing Tessa to roll out of its path and launch herself to her feet. She glanced from Henry to Charlotte. Henry was pale and still, crumpled beside the pillar. But Charlotte, lying where the automaton had dropped her, was in imminent danger of being crushed by the rampaging machine. Taking a deep breath, Tessa dashed across the room to Charlotte and knelt down, laying her fingers to Charlotte's throat. There was a pulse there, fluttering weakly. Putting her hands under Charlotte's arms, she began to drag her toward the wall, away from the center of the room, where the automaton was spinning and spitting sparks, reaching up with its pincered hands to claw at Jem and Will. They were too quick for it, though. Tessa laid Charlotte down among the burlap sacks of tea and gazed across the room, trying to determine a path that might lead her to Henry. Nate was dashing back and forth, shouting and cursing at the mechanical creature. In answer, Will sawed off one of his horns and threw it at Tessa's brother. It bounced across the floor, skittering and sparking, and Nate jumped back. Will laughed. Jem, meanwhile, was clinging onto the creature's neck, doing something that Tessa could not see. The creature itself was turning in circles, but it had been designed for reaching out and grabbing what was in front of it, and its arms did not bend properly. It could not reach what was clung to the back of its neck and head. Tessa almost wanted to laugh. Will and Jem were like mice, scurrying up and down the body of a cat, driving it to distraction. But hack and slash as they might at the metal creature with their blades, they were inflicting few injuries. Their blades, which she had seen shear through iron and steel as if they were paper, were leaving only dents and scratches on the surface of the mechanical creature's body. Nate, meanwhile, was screaming and cursing.
"Shake them off!" he yelled at the automaton. "Shake them off, you great metal bastard!"
The automaton paused, then shook itself violently. Will slipped, catching onto the creature's neck at the last moment to keep himself from falling. Jem was not so lucky. He stabbed forward with his sword cane, as if he meant to drive it into the creature's body to arrest his fall, but the blade merely skidded down the creature's back. Jem fell, gracelessly, his weapon clattering, his leg bent under him.
"James!"
Will shouted. Jem dragged himself painfully to his feet. He reached for the steely at his belt, but the creature, sensing weakness, was already on him, reaching out its clawed hands. Jem took several staggering steps backward and fumbled something out of his pocket. It was smooth, oblong, metallic, the object Henry had given him in the library. He reached back a hand to throw it, and Nate was behind him suddenly, kicking out at his injured, likely broken leg. Jem didn't make a sound, but the leg went out from under him with a snapping noise and he hit the ground for a second time, the object rolling from his hand. Tessa scrambled to her feet and ran for it just as Nate did the same. They collided, his greater weight and height bearing her to the floor. She rolled as she fell, as Gabriel had taught her to absorb the impact, though the shock still left her breathless. She reached for the device with shaking fingers, but it skittered away from her. She could hear Will screaming her name, calling her to throw it to him. She stretched her hand out farther, her fingers closing around the device. And then Nate seized her by one leg and dragged her back toward him, mercilessly.
"He is bigger than I am," she thought. "Stronger than I am. More ruthless than I am. But there is one thing I can do that he cannot."
She changed. She reached out with her mind for the grip of his hand on her ankle, his skin touching her own. She reached out for the intrinsic, inborn Nate that she had always known. That spark inside him that flickered the way it did inside everyone, like a candle in a dark room. She heard him suck in his breath, and then the change took her, rippling her skin, melting her bones. The buttons at her collar and cuffs snapped as they grew in size, convulsions thrashing through her limbs, ripping her leg free of Nate's grasp. She rolled away from her brother, staggering to her feet, and saw his eyes widen as he looked at her. She was now, other than her clothes, an exact mirror image of himself. She whirled on the automaton. It was frozen, waiting for instructions, Will still clinging to its back. He raised his hand, and Tessa threw the device, silently thanking Gabriel and Gideon for the hours of knife-throwing instruction. It flew through the air in a perfect arc, and Will caught it out of the sky. Nate was on his feet.
Tessa, he snarled. What in the bloody hell do you possibly think you're...
Seize him, she shouted at the automaton, pointing at Nate.
Catch him and hold him.
The creature did not move. Tessa could hear nothing but Nate's harsh breathing beside her, and the sound of clanking from the metal creature. Will had vanished behind it and was doing something, though she could not see what.
Tessa, you're a fool, Nate hissed. This cannot work. The creature is obedient only to... I am Nathaniel Gray,
she shouted up at the metal giant.
And I order you, in the name of the Magister, to seize this man and hold him.
Nate whirled on her.
Enough of your games, you stupid little...
His words were cut off suddenly as the automaton bent and seized him in its pincered grasp. It lifted him up, up, level with its slash of a mouth, clicking and whirring inquisitively. Nate began to scream and kept screaming, witlessly, his arms flailing as Will, finished with whatever he was doing, dropped to the ground in a crouch. He shouted something at Tessa, his blue eyes wide and wild, but she couldn't hear him over her brother's screams. Her heart was slamming against her chest. She felt her hair tumble down, hitting her shoulders with a soft, heavy weight. She was herself again, the shock of what was happening too great for her to hold on to the change. Nate was still screaming. The thing had him in a terrible pincer grip. Will had begun to run, just as the creature staring at Tessa reared up with a roar, and Will struck her, knocking her to the ground and covering her with his body as the automaton blew apart like an exploding star. The cacophony of bursting, clattering metal was incredible. Tessa tried to cover her ears, but Will's body was pinning her firmly to the ground. His elbows dug into the floor on either side of her. She felt his breath on the back of her neck, the pounding of his heart against her spine. She heard her brother cry out, a terrible gurgling cry. She turned her head, pressing her face into Will's shoulder as his body jacked against hers. The floor shuddered beneath them. And it was over. Slowly Tessa opened her eyes. The air was cloudy, with plaster dust and floating splinters and tea from the torn burlap sacks. Huge chunks of metal lay scattered haphazardly about the floor, and several of the windows had burst open, letting in foggy evening light. Tessa's glance darted about the room. She saw Henry, cradling Charlotte, kissing her pale face as she gazed up at him. Jem, struggling to his feet, steely in hand and plaster dust coating his clothes and hair. And Nate. At first, she thought he was leaning against one of the pillars. Then she saw the spreading red stain across his shirt and realized. A jagged chunk of metal had gone through him like a spear, pinning him upright to the pillar. His head was down, his hands clawing weakly at his chest.
Nate!
She screamed. Will rolled sideways, freeing her, and she was on her feet in seconds, racing across the room to her brother. Her hands were shaking with horror and revulsion, but she managed to close them around the metal spear in his chest and pull it free. She threw it aside and barely succeeded in catching him as he slumped forward, his sudden dead weight bearing her to the ground. Somehow, she found herself on the ground, Nate's limp body stretched awkwardly across her lap. A memory rose in her mind. Her crouching on the floor at De Quincey's townhouse, holding Nate in her arms. She had loved him then, trusted him. Now, as she held him, and his blood soaked into her shirt and trousers, she felt as if she were watching actors on a stage, playing parts, acting out grief.
Nate,
she whispered. His eyes fluttered open. A pang of shock went through her. She had thought he was already dead. Tessie. His voice sounded thick, as if it were coming through layers of water. His eyes roamed her face, then the blood on her clothes, and then finally came to rest on his own chest, where his blood pumped steadily through a massive rent in his shirt. Tessa shrugged off her jacket, wadded it up, and pressed it against the hard wound, praying it would be enough to make the blood stop. It wasn't. The jacket was soaked through instantly, thin wet streams of blood running down Nate's side.
Oh, God,
Tessa whispered. She raised her voice.
Will?
Don't. Nate's hand seized her wrist, his nails digging in.
But Nate...
I'm dying. I know. He coughed a loose, wet, rattling sound. Don't you understand? I failed the Magister. He'll kill me anyway. And he'll make it slow. He made a hoarse, impatient noise. Leave it, Tessie. I'm not being noble. You know I'm not that. She took a ragged breath.
I should leave you here to die, alone, in your own blood. That's what you'd do if it were me.
Tessie. A stream of blood spilled from the corner of his mouth.
The Magister was never going to hurt you.
Mortmain? She whispered. Nate, where is he? Please, tell me where he is.
He, Nate choked, heaving in a breath. A bubble of blood appeared on his lips.
The jacket in Tessa's hand was a sodden rag. His eyes went wide, starkly terrified.
Tessie, I'm dying. I'm really dying.
Questions still exploded through her head.
Where is Mortmain? How could my mother be a shadow hunter? If my father was a demon, how is it that I'm still alive when all the offspring of shadow hunters and demons are stillborn?
But the terror in Nate's eyes silenced her. Despite everything, she found her hand slipping into his.
There's nothing to be afraid of, Nate. Not for you, maybe. You were always the good one. I'm going to burn, Tessie. Tessie, where's your angel?
She put her hand to her throat, a reflexive gesture.
I couldn't wear it. I was pretending to be Jessamine. You must wear it.
He coughed. More blood.
Wear it always. You swear?
She shook her head.
Nate. I can't trust you, Nate.
I know. His voice was a bare rattle.
There's no forgiveness for the kinds of things I've had to do.
She tightened her grip on his hand, her fingers slippery with blood.
I forgive you,
she whispered, not knowing or caring if it were true. His blue eyes widened. His face had gone the color of old yellow parchment, his lips almost white.
You don't know everything I've done, Tessie.
She leaned over him anxiously.
Nate?
But there was no reply. His face went slack, his eyes wide, half rolled back in his head. His hand slid out of hers and struck the floor.
Nate,
she said again, and put her fingers to the place where his pulse should have beat in his throat, already knowing what she would find. There was nothing. He was dead. Tessa stood up. Her torn waistcoat, her trousers, her shirt, even the ends of her hair, were soaked with Nate's blood. She felt as numb as if she had been dipped in ice-cold water. She turned, slowly, only now, and for the first time, wondering if the others had been watching her, overhearing her conversation with Nate, wondering. They weren't even looking in her direction. They were kneeling, Charlotte, Jem, and Henry, in a loose circle around a dark shape on the floor, just where she had been lying before, with Will on top of her. Will. Tessa had had dreams before in which she had been walking down a long, darkened corridor towards something dreadful, something she could not see but knew was terrifying and deadly. In the dreams, with each step, the corridor had gotten longer, stretching farther into the darkness and horror. That same feeling of dread and helplessness overwhelmed her now as she moved forward, each step feeling like a mile, until she had joined the circle of kneeling shadow hunters and was looking down at Will. He lay on his side,
His face was white, his breathing shallow. Jem had one hand on his shoulder and was speaking to him in a low, soothing voice, but Will gave no sign of being able to hear him. Blood had pooled under him, smearing the floor, and for a moment Tessa just stared, unable to fathom where it had come from. Then she moved closer and saw his back. His gear had been shredded along his spine and shoulder blades, the thick material torn by flying shards of razored metal. His skin swam with blood. His hair was soaked with it.
Will?
Tessa whispered. She felt peculiarly dizzy, as if she were floating. Charlotte looked up. Tessa, she said. Your brother.
He's dead,
Tessa said through her daze.
But Will...
He knocked you down and covered you to protect you from the explosion, Jem said. There was no blame in his voice.
But there was nothing to protect him.
You two were the closest to the blast. The metal fragments shredded his back. He's losing blood quickly.
But there isn't anything you can do?
Tessa's voice rose, even as dizziness threatened to envelop her.
What about your healing runes? The Arazis?
We used an Amissio, a rune that slows blood loss, but if we attempt a healing rune, his skin will heal over the metal, driving it farther into the soft tissue,
said Henry, flatly. We need to get him back home to the infirmary. The metal must be removed before he can be healed.
Then we must go.
Tessa's voice was shaking.
We must...
Tessa, said Jim. He still had his hand on Will's shoulder, but he was looking at her, his eyes wide.
Did you know you're hurt?
She gestured impatiently at her shirt.
This isn't my blood. This is Nate's. Now we must... Can he be carried? Is there anything?
No,
Jem interrupted, sharply enough to surprise her.
Not the blood on your clothes. You've a gash on your head. Here.
He touched his temple.
Don't be ridiculous, Tessa said. I'm perfectly all right.
She put her hands up to touch her temple and felt her hair thick and stiff with blood and the side of her face sticky with it. Before her fingertips touched the ragged flap of torn skin that ran from the corner of her cheek to her temple, a searing bolt of pain shot through her head. It was the last straw. Already weak from blood loss and dizzy from repeated shocks, she felt herself begin to crumple. She barely felt Jem's arms go around her as she fell into the darkness. Chapter 17. In Dreams. Come to me in my dreams, and then by day I shall be well again. For then the night will more than pay the hopeless longing of the day. Matthew Arnold. Longing.
Consciousness came and went in a hypnotic rhythm, like the sea appearing and disappearing on the deck of a boat in a storm. Tessa knew she lay in a bed with crisp white sheets in the center of a long room, that there were other beds, all the same, in the room, and that there were windows high above her, letting in shadows, and then the bloody light of dawn. She closed her eyes against it, and the darkness came again. She woke to whispering voices and faces hovering over her, anxious. Charlotte, her hair knotted back neatly, still in her gear, and beside her brother Enoch. His scarred face was no longer a terror. She could hear his voice in her mind. The wound to her head is superficial. But she fainted, said Charlotte. To Tessa's surprise, there was real fear in her voice, real anxiety. With a blow to the head. She fainted from repeated shocks. Her brother died in her arms, you said, and she may have thought Will was dead as well. You said he covered her with his body when the explosion occurred. If he had died, he would have given his life for her. That is quite a burden to bear.
But you do think she'll be well again?
When her body and spirit have rested, she will wake. I cannot say when that will be.
Oh, my poor Tessa!
Charlotte touched Tessa's face lightly. Her hand smelled of lemon soap.
She has no one in the world at all now.
The darkness returned, and Tessa fell into it, grateful for the respite from light and thought. She wrapped herself in it like a blanket and let herself float, like the icebergs off the coast of Labrador, cradled in the moonlight by icy black water. A guttural cry of pain cut through her dream of darkness. She was curled on her side in a tangle of sheets, and a few beds away from her lay Will on his stomach. She realized, though in her state of numbness it was only a faint shock, that he was probably naked. The sheets had been drawn up to his waist, but his back and chest were bare. His arms were folded on the pillows in front of him, his head resting on them, his body tensed like a bowstring. Blood spotted the white sheets beneath him. Brother Enoch stood at one side of his bed, and beside him Jem, at Will's head, wearing an anxious expression.
"Will," Jem said urgently. "Will, are you sure you won't have another pain-killing rune?"
"No. More," Will ground out between his teeth. "Just get it over with."
Brother Enoch raised what looked like a wickedly sharp pair of silver tweezers. Will gulped and buried his head in his arms, his dark hair startling against the white of the sheets. Jem shuddered, as if the pain were his own, as the tweezers dug deep into Will's back and his body tautened on the bed, muscles tensing under the skin, his cry of agony short and muffled. Brother Enoch drew back the tool, a blood-smeared shard of metal gripped in its teeth. Jem slid his hand into Will's.
"Grip my fingers. It will help the pain. There are only a few more."
"Easy for you to say,"
Will gasped, but the touch of his pyrobatized hand seemed to relax him slightly. He was arched up off the bed, his elbows digging into the mattress, his breath coming in short pants. Tessa knew she ought to look away, but she couldn't. She realized she had never seen so much of a boy's body before, not even Jem's. She found herself fascinated by the way the lean muscle slid under Will's smooth skin, the flex and swell of his arms, the hard, flat stomach convulsing as he breathed. The tweezers flashed again, and Will's hand bore down on Jem's, both their fingers whitening. Blood welled and spilled down his bare side. He made no sound, though Jem looked sick and pale. He moved his hand as if to touch Will's shoulder, then drew it back, biting down on his lip.
"All this because Will covered my body with his to protect me," Tessa thought.
As Brother Enoch had said, it was a burden to bear, indeed. She lay on her narrow bed in her old room in the New York flat. Through the window she could see gray sky, the rooftops of Manhattan. One of her aunt's colorful patchwork quilts was on the bed, and she clutched it to her as the door opened and her aunt herself came in. Knowing what she knew now, Tessa could see the resemblance. Aunt Harriet had blue eyes, faded, fair hair. Even the shape of her face was like Nate's. With a smile, she came and bent over Tessa, putting a hand on her forehead, cool against Tessa's hot skin.
"I'm so sorry," Tessa whispered. "About Nate. It's my fault he's dead."
"Hush," her aunt said. "It isn't your fault. It is his and mine. I always felt such guilt, you see, Tessa, knowing I was his mother, but not being able to bear telling him. I let him get away with anything he wanted until he was spoiled beyond saving. If I had told him that I was really his mother, he would not have felt so betrayed when he discovered the truth, and would not have turned against us. Lies and secrets, Tessa, they are like a cancer in the soul. They eat away what is good, and leave only destruction behind."
"I miss you so much," Tessa said. "I have no family now."
Her aunt leaned forward to kiss her on the forehead.
"You have more family than you think."
"We will almost certainly forfeit the Institute now," said Charlotte.
She did not sound broken-hearted, but distant and detached. Tessa was hovering like a ghost over the infirmary, looking down at where Charlotte stood with Jem at the foot of Tessa's own bed. Tessa could see herself, asleep, her dark hair spread like a fan across her pillows. Will lay asleep a few beds over, his back striped with bandages, an Eratzi black against the back of his neck. Sophie, in her white cap and dark dress, was dusting the windowsills.
"We have lost Nathaniel Gray as a source. One of our own has turned out to be a spy, and we are no closer to finding Mortmain than we were a fortnight ago. After all that we have done, have learned, the Clave will understand. They will not. They are already at the end of their tether where I am concerned. I might as well march over to Benedict Lightwood's house and make over the Institute paperwork in his name, have done with it." "What does Henry say about all this?" asked Jem. He was no longer in gear, and neither was Charlotte. He wore a white shirt and brown cloth trousers, and Charlotte was in one of her drab dark dresses. As Jem turned his hand over, though, Tessa saw that it was still spotted with Will's dried blood. Charlotte snorted in an unladylike manner. "Oh, Henry," she said, sounding exhausted. "I think he's just so shocked that one of his devices actually worked that he doesn't know what to do with himself. And he can't bear to come in here. He thinks it's his fault that Will and Tessa are hurt.
Without that device, we might all be dead, and Tessa in the hands of the Magister."
"You are welcome to explain that to Henry. I have given up the attempt."
"Charlotte," Jem's voice was soft, "I know what people say. I know you've heard the cruel gossip. But Henry does love you. When he thought you were hurt at the tea warehouse, he went almost mad. He threw himself against that machine."
"James,"
Charlotte clumsily patted Jem's shoulder,
"I do appreciate your attempt to console me. But falsehoods never do anyone any good in the end. I long ago accepted that Henry loves his inventions first and me second, if at all."
"Charlotte," Jem said wearily. Before he could say another word, Sophie had moved to stand beside him, dustcloth in hand.
"Mrs. Branwell,"
she said in a low voice,
"if I might speak to you for just a moment."
Charlotte looked surprised.
"Sophie?"
"Please, ma'am."
Charlotte placed a hand on Jem's shoulder, said something softly into his ear, and then nodded toward Sophie.
"Very well, but come with me to the drawing room."
As Charlotte left the room with Sophie, Tessa realized to her surprise that Sophie was actually taller than her mistress. Charlotte's presence was such that one often forgot how very small she was. And Sophie was as tall as Tessa herself, as slender as a willow. Tessa saw her again in her mind with Gideon Lightwood, pressed up against the corridor wall, and Tessa worried. As the door closed behind the two women, Jem leaned forward, his arms crossed over the foot of Tessa's brass bed. He was looking at her, smiling a little, though crookedly, his hands hanging loose, dried blood across the knuckles and under the nails.
"Tessa, my Tessa,"
he said in his soft voice, as lulling as his violin. "I know you cannot hear me. Brother Enoch says you're not hurt badly.
I can't say I find that enough to comfort me.
It's rather like when Will assures me that you're only a little bit lost somewhere. I know it means we won't be seeing a familiar street again for hours." He dropped his voice, so low that Tessa wasn't sure if what he said next was real or part of the dream darkness rising to claim her, though she fought against it.
"I have never minded it," he went on.
"Being lost, that is. I had always thought one could not be truly lost if one knew one's own heart. But I fear I may be lost without knowing yours."
He closed his eyes as if he were bone-weary, and she saw how thin his eyelids were, like parchment paper, and how tired he looked.
"Woe I me, Tessa,"
he whispered.
"Wo bu shang, shi kui ni."
She knew, without knowing how she knew, what the words meant.
"I love you, and I don't want to lose you. I don't want to lose you either,"
she wanted to say, but the words wouldn't come. Lassitude rose up instead, in a dark wave, and covered her in silence. darkness. It was dark in the cell, and Tessa was conscious first of a feeling of great loneliness and terror. Jessamine lay in the narrow bed, her fair hair hanging in lank ropes over her shoulders. Tessa both hovered over her and felt somehow as if she were touching her mind. She could feel a great aching sense of loss. Somehow, Jessamine knew that Nate was dead. Before, when Tessa had tried to touch the other girl's mind, she had met resistance, but now she felt only a growing sadness, like the stain of a drop of black ink spreading through water. Jessie's brown eyes were open, staring up into the darkness.
I have nothing.
The words were as clear as a bell in Tessa's mind.
I chose Nate over the Shadow Hunters, and now he is dead. And Mortmain would want me dead as well. And Charlotte despises me. I have gambled and lost everything.
As Tessa watched, Jessamine reached up and drew a small cord from her neck over her head. At the end of the cord was a gold ring with a glittering white stone, a diamond. Clasping it between her fingers, she began to use the diamond to scratch letters into the stone wall. J. G. Jessamine Gray. There might have been more to the message, but Tessa would never find out. As Jessamine pressed down on the gemstone, it shattered, and her hand slammed against the wall, scraping her knuckles. Tessa did not need to touch Jessamine's mind to know what she was thinking. Even the diamond had not been real. With a low cry, Jessamine rolled over and buried her face in the rough blankets of the bed. When Tessa woke again, it was dark. Faint starlight streamed through the high infirmary windows, and there was a witchlight lamp lit on the table near her bed. Beside it was a cup of tisane, steam rising from it, and a small plate of biscuits. She rose to a sitting position, about to reach for the cup, and froze. Will was seated on the bed beside her.